end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you, do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
I think people should be ready to organize on election night and be prepared for the worst possible outcome. And we need to, if we're going to achieve democracy in this country, it's going to have to be won by people out on the streets and organizing from below. And that's, I think, the way it's always been. And I don't think it's going to be any different after election night. So I hope people are making preparations for that.
Thank you, Bill Mullen. Thank you very much for your fine work in this excellent interview. Bill, tell our audience how people can stay in touch with you and your work.
My book with Janelle Hope on Black Anti-Fascism is available from Haymarket Books, and my We Charge Genocide book is available from Fordham University Press, and I'm on Facebook, but I don't really do a lot of other social media. My email address is at the Purdue University website, where I'm a professor emeritus. People could reach out to me through that email if they'd like to have a conversation.
Very good. Thank you so much, Bill Mullen, for being our guest on Law and Disorder Radio. You take it easy.
Thanks, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss former President Jimmy Carter's record and legacy on human rights, including the enduring Carter Center.
Human rights journalist Misha Garagoulis from the Project Censor joins us to discuss the model that Jimmy Carter established for U.S. foreign policy.
We also speak with Norman Solomon, who's just reissued his great book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine.
His new afterword to the book focuses on the corporate media's biased coverage of the Israeli-U.S. war in Gaza.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Jimmy Carter passed away on December 29, 2024, at the age of 100. His legacy in human rights has left an indelible mark on global diplomacy. Elected in 1977, Carter made human rights a central theme of his administration. He believed that as a global power, the U.S. had a responsibility to champion freedom, dignity, and justice for all people, regardless of nationality or political system. This vision led to the introduction of policies aimed at addressing both the internal injustices within the U.S. and the broader human rights violations occurring around the world. One of Carter's most significant achievements in this realm was condemning authoritarian regimes and promoting democratic movements. His administration applied pressure on governments, particularly in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, to uphold human rights standards, often linking U.S. foreign aid and diplomatic relations to a country's record on human rights. Though controversial at times, especially in relation to U.S. alliances with regimes like those in Iran and Egypt, Carter's commitment to human rights was revolutionary in its directness. The Carter Center, founded in 1982, became a beacon for promoting democracy, advancing health, and improving human rights globally. Through the center, Carter monitored elections, mediated peace talks, and worked to eliminate diseases that disproportionately affected the world's most vulnerable populations. After leaving office, Carter's work as a human rights advocate set a new standard for U.S. foreign policy, showing that human rights can be a priority in shaping international relations and peace efforts. Joining us today is human rights editor and writer Misha Jerakulis. She is the Curriculum Development Coordinator for Project Censored and author of the forthcoming book to be published by Routledge, Media Framing and the Destruction of Cultural Heritage. Misha, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Heidi, it's my pleasure. Thank you to you and to Steve for having me.
And it's wonderful, actually, that we're recording on the National Day of Mourning for Jimmy Carter. Carter is often regarded as one of the most human rights-focused U.S. presidents. What first inspired his dedication to this cause?
You know, Heidi, Carter had campaigned on the intention to restore trust in the...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There's big challenges ahead of us. Roads will need to be cleared, shelters need to be set up, and supplies need to flow in. We hope that this will all be possible in the coming weeks, as well as the returns of hundreds of thousands of people from the south to the north.
The ceasefire in Gaza has entered its second day. We'll go to Ramallah and to Jerusalem. Then ahead of Donald Trump's inauguration as president for a second time, thousands march in protest across the United States. We'll hear voices from the People's March in Washington, D.C., and the Peace Ball.
That it was Dr. King who said that that we cannot capitulate to finite disappointments. And what we do is we confront those finite disappointments with infinite hope. And that is what we are in the process of doing.
And on this federal holiday celebrating the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we'll hear part of his last speech the night before he was assassinated.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The ceasefire in Gaza has entered its second day. On Sunday, Hamas released three Israeli women who'd been held captive for 471 days since October 7, 2023. All three were reported in stable condition as they reunited with their families. Israel released 90 Palestinian prisoners, all women and children, the youngest being 15 years old. Under the terms of the ceasefire, Hamas will release 30 more Israeli captives, and Israel will release 1,890, that's 1,890 Palestinians, over the next 6 weeks. This comes as thousands of displaced Palestinians in Gaza have begun trying to return home now that Israel's 15-month bombing campaign has ended. Amal Abu Eita returned to her home in the largest refugee camp in northern Gaza, Jabalia, to find nothing but rubble.
We will try to close this door and stay here. Where should we go? Where should we go? Our home is gone. Our situation is destroyed. Where can we go? 10 children. Where should I go with them in the tents? Where should I go with them on the streets? We are trying to find a place to shelter in. What is our situation? The same as all Arabs. This is what eases our pain a little, knowing that our situation is like that of the rest of the Arabs.
The ceasefire went into effect on Sunday after Israel Israel's cabinet approved the deal. Israel's far-right national security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir resigned from Netanyahu's cabinet in protest. On Saturday, Netanyahu said Israel reserves the right to resume attacks on Gaza.
Both President Trump and President Biden gave full backing to Israel's right to return to fighting. If Israel reaches the conclusion that negotiations of the second stage is fruitless, I appreciate it very much. If we need to resume fighting, we will do that in new ways, and we will do it with great force.
Israel killed about 200 Palestinians after the ceasefire was first agreed to on Wednesday. We'll have more on the Gaza ceasefire after headlines. We'll go to Jerusalem and Ramallah. President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect J.D. Vance are being sworn in today inside the Capitol Rotunda. The inaugural ceremony was moved inside for the first time since 1985 due, President Trump said, to cold weather. Attendees at the inauguration include tech billionaires Elon Musk, Amazon founder and Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, Apple CEO Tim Cook, and Google's Sundar Pichai. On Sunday, Trump held a rally at the Capital One Arena where he vowed to spend his first day back in the White House issuing a blitz of executive orders.
We're going to stop the invasion of our borders. We're going to reclaim our wealth. We're going to unlock the liquid gold that's right under our feet. Liquid gold. We're going to bring back law and order to our cities. We're going to restore patriotism to our schools, get radical left woke ideologies the hell out of our military and out of our government. And we are going to make America great again.
It's expected Trump will issue about 50 executive orders today after he's inaugurated. On Saturday, thousands of people gathered in Washington, D.C. for a People's March to protest Trump's inauguration. 300 other marches were held across the country. Well, our experts, excerpts from the D.C. protest later in the broadcast. Immigrant communities across the United States are fearing the coming days as Trump has threatened to begin carrying out mass deportations. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, had said Chicago would be, quote, ground zero for the initial raids, but he's since walked back his comment. Jose Munoz is co-chair of the Illinois Latino Agenda.
Individuals and families are worried about what potentially could happen. They're worried about deportation. But the biggest blow to our community is living in fear. You know, when communities are living in fear, they don't go to work, they don't go to school. Long-term, that has an impact not just on the immigrant communities, but it has an impact on our entire city and entire country as a whole, because we rely on immigrant labor. We have our growth, our population, our consumers. A very large portion of them are immigrants that are coming into the U.S. And so when they're in fear, it impacts all of us.
On Friday, Donald Trump launched his own cryptocurrency, which quickly soared to nearly $12 billion in value. Ethics experts question the legality of the move, which has already dramatically increased Trump's wealth by billions of dollars, at least on paper. Adav Noti of the Campaign Legal Center told the New York Times, quote, it's literally cashing in on the presidency. It's beyond unprecedented, unquote. On Sunday, Trump's wife, Melania, also launched her own cryptocurrency. This comes as Donald Trump has vowed to deregulate the cryptocurrency sector. The popular social media app TikTok's accessible again in the United States after Trump vowed to issue an executive order to delay a ban on the app, which is used by 170 million people in the United States. The app became briefly inaccessible in the U.S. over the weekend after the Supreme Court unanimously upheld a federal law to ban TikTok starting January 19th, unless its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, sold it to a U.S. buyer. Trump's proposed the U.S. government or a U.S. firm take a 50% stake in the company. TikTok chief executive Shouzi Chu is scheduled to attend Trump's inauguration today. Earlier today, on his last day in office, President Biden issued preemptive pardons for Dr. Anthony Fauci, retired General Mark Milley, and members and staff of the January 6th House Committee, including Liz Cheney, to protect them from possible investigations by the incoming administration. In a statement, President Biden said, quote, "The issuance of these pardons should not be mistaken as an acknowledgement that any individual engaged in any wrongdoing, nor should acceptance be misconstrued as an admission of guilt for any offense. Our nation owes these public servants a debt of gratitude for their tireless commitment to our country," he said. On Sunday, Biden issued five other pardons, including one for the late Pan-Africanist and Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey, who was convicted of mail fraud in the 1920s and was deported. Biden also pardoned New York-based immigrant rights leader Ravi Ragbir, who spoke to Democracy Now! Sunday night.
"This has meant a lot for my family and myself because it stops the continued punishment that I have faced throughout the last two decades, where I every day was uncertain because I faced the possibility of deportation. In fact, in 2018, ICE made a concerted effort to kidnap me and with the intention to deport me. And it's only because of community support that I'm still standing."
Go to democracynow.org to see our last interview with Ravi Ragbir. Biden also pardoned gun violence prevention advocate Daryl Chambers, Virginia House Speaker Don Scott, and criminal justice reform advocate Kemba Smith-Pradia. President Biden on Friday declared the Equal Rights Amendment is now the law of the land.
"Today, I affirm the Equal Rights Amendment to have cleared all the necessary hurdles to be added to the U.S. Constitution now." "The Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land now. It's the 28th Amendment to the Constitution now."
The announcement drew celebration and confusion. A White House official clarified Biden's statements represented his opinion that the ERA was ratified, though never codified in the Constitution, but that he was not issuing any sort of accompanying executive action. Advocates say Biden could have taken a further step and ordered the National Archives to publish the amendment and enter it officially in the Constitution, a move which would have triggered a legal battle with Republicans. The Biden administration's declassified details on how the United States secretly helped develop Ukraine's drone program. The New York Times reports the U.S. funded the effort and sent intelligence officers to Ukraine to help build the drones which have been used to attack and spy on Russia. In Iran, a gunman assassinated two high-profile judges who served on Iran's Supreme Court. The attack took place at the Palace of Justice in Tehran Saturday. Both of the judges were clerics who'd faced threats before for their role in the mass execution of Iranian dissidents in 1988. Colombian authorities estimate more than 80 people were killed over 3 days in northeast Colombia as fighting broke out between the National Liberation Army, known as the ELN, and former members of FARC amidst failed peace talks. Thousands of people have fled Colombia's Catatumbo region as a result. FARC disarmed under a 2016 peace deal, but a number of its former members remain active or have joined other armed groups. The government of President Gustavo Petro, who's vowed to end such violence in Colombia, has suspended talks with the ELN, which it accused of war crimes. The U.S. Justice Department has filed a lawsuit against Walgreens for its role in fueling the deadly opioid epidemic. The lawsuit accuses Walgreens of knowingly rushing to fill millions of unlawful prescriptions, including dangerous and excessive quantities of opioids, starting in 2012. Atlanta residents are demanding accountability after city workers killed Cornelius Taylor, an unhoused man, by bulldozing over him as they cleared an encampment near the Ebenezer Baptist Church ahead of MLK Day celebrations. Witnesses say the workers did not check the tents beforehand to make sure they were empty. The group Housing Justice League said the sweep was part of an effort to present a, quote, false sanitized vision of Atlanta, adding, quote, everyone deserves to live in dignity. And the leadership of the American Historical Association has vetoed a, quote, resolution to oppose scholasticide in Gaza. unquote. That was overwhelmingly backed by members of the AHA earlier this month. The group Historians for Palestine accused AHA leadership of pandering to the political class, adding, quote, the AHA is our organization. We urge historians to recognize this anti-democratic silencing as complicity in scholasticide, unquote. To learn more about the resolution, go to democracynow.org to see our interview with two AHA members after the vote took place at the business meeting overwhelmingly. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The ceasefire in Gaza has entered its second day. On Sunday, Hamas released three Israeli women who'd been held captive for 471 days since October 7th, 2023. All three were reported in stable condition as they reunited with their families. Israel released 90 Palestinian prisoners, all women and children, the youngest being 15 years old. Under the terms of the ceasefire deal, Hamas will release 30 more Israeli captives, and Israel will release 1,890 Palestinians over the next 6 weeks. This comes as thousands of displaced Palestinians in Gaza have begun trying to return home now that Israel's 15-month bombing campaign has ended. Amal Abu Eita returned her home in the Jabalia refugee camp to find nothing but rubble.
We will try to close this door and stay here. Where should we go? Where should we go? Our home is gone. Our situation is destroyed. Where can we go? 10 children. Where should I go with them in the tents? Where should I go with them on the streets? We are trying to find a place to shelter in. What is our situation? The same as all Arabs. This is what eases our pain a little, knowing that our situation is like that of the rest of the Arabs.
The ceasefire went into effect Sunday after Israel's cabinet approved the deal. Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, resigned from Netanyahu's cabinet in protest. On Saturday, Netanyahu said Israel reserves the right to resume attacks on Gaza.
Both President Trump and President Biden gave full backing to Israel's right to return to fighting. If Israel reaches the conclusion that negotiations of the second stage is fruitless, I appreciate it very much. If we need to resume fighting, we will do that in new ways, and we will do it with great force.
Israel killed another 200 Palestinians after the ceasefire was first agreed on Wednesday. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Jerusalem, Gershon Baskin is with us, Middle East director of the International Communities Organization, a human rights advocacy group. He's a longtime back-channel negotiator with Hamas and ceasefire deals. His memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. And in Ramallah, in the occupied West Bank, we're joined by Tala Nasser. She is a lawyer with the Palestinian prisoner and human rights organization, Admir. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Tala, let's begin with you. If you can talk about, we will talk with Gershon Baskin about who the Israelis are, the three women who were released this weekend. I want to start with you asking about the 90 Palestinians and who they are, as you are a lawyer with the prisoners' organization.
Yes, so yesterday, Palestinian prisoners were supposed to be released after 3 p.m., but unfortunately, the Israeli authorities delayed the release until 3 a.m. Today. 92 Palestinian prisoners were released, including 69 female prisoners. Two of them are child prisoners. 20 of them are administrative detainees, 5 of them were sentenced prisoners, and 44 were under trial, while they also released 23 child prisoners. Most of them were under administrative detention, and some of them were under trial. And also, six of the released prisoners yesterday were actually previously released in the November 23 exchange deal, and then they were re-arrested again. So these are the Palestinians who were released yesterday, and of course we're waiting for the other phases or the other batches of the prisoners to be released.
And just for people to understand globally who don't know the Israeli system, when you say they were held administratively, you were saying they were held without charge or trial.
Yes, they were actually held without any charges, without any trial. It's based on a secret trial that neither the detainee nor their lawyers know anything about the charges or the accusations and why they are arrested.
And overall, your feeling about the ceasefire, at least for these next 42 days?
We're actually concerned of what will actually going to happen in the next few weeks, because yesterday it was horrible. Families were actually waiting for long hours in front of Ofer prison. They were assaulted. The Israeli occupation forces started bombing the families, started using sound bombs, gas, rubber bullets, and live ammunition. There were lots of injuries in front of Rafah prison. So also families were also assaulted in the occupied Jerusalem. They were summoned to Al-Maskoubiyeh interrogation center. They were subjected to arbitrary conditions that prohibited gatherings and banned marches and fireworks and prevented them from chanting slogans. So the situation is still, we're still concerned of the situation. We're hoping that it will continue, the Israelis will continue to release prisoners and of course we have no guarantees they will not be rearrested again, but we are hopeful that many other prisoners will be released, especially the ones who are serving life sentences.
Gershon Baskin, you're in Jerusalem right now. If you could respond overall to how the ceasefire was achieved, talk about the three Israeli women as well as the 92 Palestinians who were released.
Right, the ceasefire deal that was negotiated primarily in Doha over the last weeks, it happened because Donald Trump told Benjamin Netanyahu to make the deal now. He wanted this deal done before he entered the White House. The deal was actually almost the same deal that was presented by President Biden way back in May. And cynically, it wasn't achieved until a few days before January 20th, when Donald Trump takes the Oval Office. Steve Witkoff, the Middle East emissary of Donald Trump, worked hand in hand with Brett McGurk from the Biden administration to make sure that the deal was done in Doha. And as I said, It's more or less the same deal that was presented back in May. I have to comment, it is a bad deal. It's a bad deal for Israel. It's a bad deal for the Palestinians. It's a deal which will take months to implement and create a lot more suffering for the families of hostages, for the families of prisoners, and the chances of a derailing in the Gaza Strip are very high. The three women who were released are Roni Gonen, 24 years old, Emily Damari, 28 years old, and Doron Stanbrecher, 31 years old. Two of them were from Kibbutz Kfar Aza next to the Gaza Strip, and one of them was taken from the Nova Festival on October 7th. They're all civilians. None of them are military. None of them had anything to do with the Israeli occupation. They were Israeli citizens trying to live their lives.
And the Palestinians that were released, and then the additional, 1,890 Palestinians who will be released, to underscore what Tala was just saying about they were all women and children, but the overwhelming majority had not been tried or charged.
Yeah, I understand there are about 1,000 administrative detainees who will be released in this first part of the deal for 33 of the Israeli hostages. 94 hostages will remain in Gaza until the negotiations are completed on phase two, which will begin on day 16 and are supposed to be completed by day 30 before we enter another 42-week period. Hopefully it will happen. Hopefully the ceasefire will hold, and this is supposed to lead to an end to the war. It seems to me that Hamas would not have agreed to enter into this two or three phase deal without having guarantees, both from Qatar and from Egypt through the United States, that in fact the war would end and will not continue beyond this first phase of the first 42 days. But we don't know that because Netanyahu has given alternative promises to members of the government that Israel reserves the right to return the war to war if the negotiations don't end up moving in the direction that they want.
And the significance of Ben-Gvir, along with another MK, member of Knesset, or known around the world as member of parliament, the significance of the far-right member of the cabinet and member of the Knesset, Ben-Gvir quitting?
Right. Well, Ben-Gvir also admitted that he was successful in holding up this deal for months, which should be criminal, and he should be treated as criminal in the eyes of the Israeli public. I started by saying that this is a bad deal, but a bad deal is better than no deal. Certainly, Ben-Gvir's resignation from the cabinet and not being our minister for national security is a cherry on the cake that was unexpected, and it certainly made the deal a little bit sweeter for us Israelis who would like to live in a normal country. Ben-Gvir is a danger to our society, is a danger to our democracy. I think he's a danger to the entire region. And the further away he is from power, the better it is for all of us.
Does he remain in the parliament or in the Knesset or just quit as a cabinet member?
He just quits as a cabinet member. He remains in the parliament. But a number of the parliamentarians from his party became members of parliament on what's called the Norwegian War here. When ministers enter the government, they can resign their Knesset seat, their parliament seat, and bring in additional people from the party. Apparently, two of the members of his party now have to also be removed from the Knesset, which is also a blessing.
And Bezalel Smotrich did ultimately, though he threatened to leave, remain.
Yeah, he remained. He cynically put out a tweet on X congratulating the return of the hostages that he tried to block. He voted against the deal. There's no end to the cynicism within the Israeli government.
Tala, if you can talk about the release of Akhleda Jarar, a Palestinian parliamentarian, a member of the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Yeah, so Khalida was released yesterday. She was completely isolated from the outside world for five months now. She was released with a horrible condition, actually, because of the isolation, because of the starvation imposed against her and other women prisoners, because of the lack of personal hygiene tools, the confiscation of clothes and electrical appliances, the denial of medical care. So she was released in a very horrible situation, and people around the world saw the pictures of how she was released. And it's not only about Khalida Jarar, but it's also other women prisoners who were also released in a very bad situation, and they were subjected to different torture and ill-treatment methods, which led to their to them lose their, so much of their weight. They were starving inside the prisons, and that's why we saw them in this horrible situation.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we will continue to follow this extremely closely. Tala Nasser is lawyer with Admir, the Palestinian Prisoners Organization. She's speaking to us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And Gershon Baskin, longtime back-channel negotiator with Hamas in ceasefire deals. Up next, ahead of Donald Trump's second inauguration as president, thousands marched in protest Saturday across the United States. We'll hear voices from the People's March in Washington, D.C., then to Angela Davis at the inaugural Peace Ball. Stay with us.
Hello.
Matini, My Homeland, sung by journalists in Gaza 1 year after they first recorded in the midst of Israel's attacks. The song is based on a poem by the Palestinian poet Ibrahim Tukan from 1934. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Ahead of President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration today, thousands march in protest across the United States Saturday. Democracy Now!'s team, we were in Washington, D.C. when thousands came out to join the People's March. Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're at the People's March in Washington, D.C., 2 days before the inauguration of Donald Trump. People are carrying banners that say, "We will not be silent. Together we can. Together we will. Your power, our power, people power." There are many people. One person was holding a sign that said, "MAGA, morons are governing America." And there are many other issues. People are talking about women's rights, trans rights, LGBTQ rights, talking about the rights of Palestinians, D.C., statehood, and much more. We'll talk to people in the crowd.
Trust black women!
Trust black women!
Trust black women!
How you doing? I'm Hope Giselle. I'm the executive director of the National Trans Visibility March, and I'm out here because all of us deserve the space to feel like we have a voice in democracy. All of us deserve to feel like human beings, and all of us deserve to have our rights respected. And so without a democracy, without a true democracy, we all fall to the wayside of a corruption and a government that does not see us as human beings, and I refuse to allow that to stand.
My name is Nicole. I come from Garfield, New Jersey, and my sign says, "If you're not angry, you're not paying attention."
What does that mean to you?
It means that you have to join the fight.
My name's Anova. I came from Oregon. My sign says liberation for all of us, and the people are stronger than fear.
My name is Caleb, and my sign says, "I am mad, very mad."
My name is Ann Wright. I'm a retired U.S. Army colonel and a former diplomat. I resigned in 2003 in opposition to the war in Iraq. Therefore, I'm here for the People's March and a march for peace.
And you're standing in front of the Free Palestine contingent. Talk about what you want to see and what you hope for Trump.
I hope that Trump will stop the aid, the military aid that we are giving to Israel that is so complicit in the genocide of Gaza. We hope the ceasefire will hold so that no more Palestinians are killed. But we, the people of the world, have to put pressure, continue to put pressures on our governments, that they put pressures on the Israelis to stop this genocide.
My name is Beth Miller. I'm the political director with Jewish Voice for Peace. And we're here today as part of the contingent with the Palestinian Freedom Movement that is part of the broader anti-war contingent. And we're here because we are showing up as part of the broader resistance to this incoming fascist authoritarian regime. And we're here to make clear that all of our liberations from here in the U.S. to Palestine and everywhere in between are connected. And we understand that fascism here, fascism in Israel, requires a big, broad, united front.
When teachers are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up.
I'm originally from Texas, but we came from Florida. We drove from Florida to come to attend this. So it's been on my bucket list for a while, and I just am really passionate about the government staying out of my body, and everybody should have right to their own body and rights for the same as everybody else. And I just don't think that that's happening right now. And I think that this country was founded on protest and fighting for what you believe in.
Could you read your sign, please, and describe it?
It's a naked woman with, it says, "Keep your policies off my body."
My name is Christabel. I'm from Delaware. I'm marching for my mom today. She is currently in Mexico and can't return. She went for her forgiveness and then was denied. This is my stepdad. He actually lives in Mexico with her, and he came all the way here to march for her today.
And what message do you have for President Trump?
My message to Trump is, F you. If you can have Melania, I want Imelda. That is my mom. Let her back in.
I'm Leslie Kagan. I'm with a fairly new group called Time to Act. And I'm here because where else would one be today? It is now is the time to stand up as loudly, as boldly, and in as big a numbers as we can to say we're not going away. We're not sitting at home quietly. We are committed to resisting what the Trump administration, the MAGA Republicans, the Heritage Foundation, the billionaires, what they're going to bring to us, the horrors that they're going to rain on our communities. So we're here to say we're not going away. We're fighting back.
And do you feel that the resistance is strong enough?
We're strong in our commitment, in our understanding of the problem, in our willingness to take bold action. We need more people. We need more people in every community of this country to be speaking out. Some will come to marches. Some will make calls to their elected officials. Some will organize community defense and protection of immigrants and other communities. So people will do it in different ways. We're not as strong as we need to be, but we can get there.
My name is Andrea Paskin. And where'd you come in from?
Eastern Pennsylvania.
I see. And were you here in 2017?
Yes.
Could you tell me about that? You came together then too?
Yes, we did. We're sisters. And we came then for the exact same reason we're here today. And that is more so, because you have to resist and resist and resist and resist. I don't know what else to say. There are just too many things to say that are going wrong. And we thought we had hopefully corrected them in 2020, and then we had an insurrection, and then we never had any peace.
Yep, sure. All our children and grandchildren need to see that you have to do something. You can't just wait around and let it happen to you. So that's why we're here.
The People's March in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. The People's March culminated in a rally in front of the Lincoln Memorial, with thousands gathered around the reflecting pool looking up at Abraham Lincoln.
Well, good morning. It is great to be here with you. My name is Ben Jealous, former national president of the NAACP, and proud to serve as the seventh executive director of the Sierra Club. Now, I tell you, this crowd today touches my heart. My mom is in a People's March in California right now. When I was 12, she took me to my first march. It was a march against rape in our community that my father organized. And so today we come here for many movements. We come here for many reasons. We also come here as human beings who are clear that we must do everything in our power to create a greener, healthier Mother Earth for all of us. And that's what my Vice President Shruti Bhatnagar and I do at Sierra Club every day. And I'll tell you this, it's January's off to a wild start for the Sierra Club. Woke up one day and Exxon was suing us. Woke up a few days later and that Twitter troll in chief Elon Musk was attacking us. You know, somebody up there has a sign that says, "Deport Musk and Murdoch." Y'all are too much this morning. But I'll tell you this, they only attack us because they fear us. They know that last time this man who comes back into office on Monday, last time that man was in office, we sued him hundreds of times and we won hundreds of times. They know that last time that man was in office, we saw him install corrupt cabinet members, and then he saw us run them out. They know that last time this man was in office, he said that we would burn more coal, and we shut down more coal-fired power plants than we had in either of Obama's first terms. No, we are powerful enough, in other words, to keep making progress no matter who is president. The people of this democracy, we don't elect politicians to make change for us. We try to elect the best politicians to make it a little easier for us to make change. But you know, when the hill gets steeper, when the weather gets colder, we don't cancel our gathering. And we keep climbing up that hill.
Ben Jealous, executive director of the Sierra Club, before that head of the NAACP, addressing the People's March in Washington, D.C.
Resist Trump. That's how you spell it. All right, y'all. Now, Popular Democracy, which is an organization of 50 organizations across the country who are like, hell no, this is our government. This is our country. It is our responsibility. We defend the 14th Amendment, and we are here to stand up and fight back. Are you with me? Now, I know, I'm pushing 50, so I feel it in my knees. I know that some of us, we're weary. We are so tired. We cannot believe that we have to do this again. Oops. I know that we are in disbelief and frankly in disappointment for the 90 million who stayed home, but it's all right because, y'all, that even though we find ourselves in this moment, we gotta know that freedom, that justice is not a final destination, y'all. This is a practice. Every day we need to make the decision, are we going to uphold a democracy and the kind of government that is for the people, or are we going to sit it out? For me, I'm going to stand up. How about you? Are you going to stand up, fight back?
That was Analilia Mejia, co-executive director, the Center for Popular Democracy, speaking at the People's March in front of the Lincoln Memorial on Saturday, addressing thousands. When we come back, we'll hear Dr. Martin Luther King on this federal holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King. But first, the inaugural Peace Ball. Stay with us.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom.
We who believe in freedom.
We who believe cannot rest until it comes. We who believe.
Until the killing of black men, black mother's son,
is as important as the killing of
Ella's song, We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest Until It Comes, by Sweet Honey and the Rock, performing Saturday night at the 2025 inaugural Peace Ball. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday night in Washington, D.C., Busboys and Poets hosted the 2025 inaugural Peace Ball, which first started in 2009 with the inauguration of President Obama. The theme was a gathering for positive change. While the event had once been held at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, this year, Busboys and Poets founder Andy Shalal was quoted in the New York Times saying that the museum had complaints about, quote, the tone of the event, even though some of the featured speakers are also featured in the museum, including the abolitionist, the author, the professor, and longtime activist Angela Davis. The event did proceed, however, at the arena stage at the Mead Center for American Theater. This is Angela Davis.
A lot more is happening in the world than the inauguration. Of someone who represents fascism in this country and the world. And if we look back at struggles for justice and equality, we find that there aren't often propitious moments for those struggles. We've always confronted waves of conservatism. And while we cannot create the conditions for the struggles in which we engage, we can bring our determination, we can bring our vision for a better future. And even as we express the deep disappointment, and I'm not going to try to enumerate all of the things about which we are collectively disappointed. But we can't find ourselves so ensconced in that disappointment that we don't create the kind of hope that will allow us to move forward and pass legacies to the next generation of people who are struggling. And we do want to join that celebration that Linda Sarsour talked about on the sands of Gaza. We want to be able to look forward to that moment. Now, I guess I should at least mention the fact that the conditions of struggle today are horrendous. And when I try to imagine what it might mean to confront, you know, all of those who are the billionaires who once were opposed to Trump, who are now offering themselves up to him. But when I think about the move toward fascism, I also celebrate the fact that we have never seen as many people stand up for the freedom of Palestine. People who were dissuaded in the past by Zionist propaganda are standing up and powerfully demanding a free Palestine. Free Palestine. And that is what we are celebrating this evening. That is what we are celebrating. Now, I think it might be propitious, I'll use that word again, that the inauguration is happening on the same day as we celebrate the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. And in that context, I want to remind us that it was Dr. King who said that that we cannot capitulate to finite disappointments. And what we do is we confront those finite disappointments with infinite hope. And that is what we are in the process of doing.
That was Angela Davis, the abolitionist, the author, the professor, the longtime activist, speaking at the 2025 inaugural Peace Ball at the Arena Stage on Saturday night. Special thanks to the whole Democracy Now! Team and to Guy Werner. This is Democracy Now! We end today's show with the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this federal holiday that honors the birthday of Dr. King. On April 4, 1968, he was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He was just 39 years old. He was in Memphis supporting striking sanitation workers as he built momentum for a Poor People's March in on Washington. This is an excerpt from Dr. King's last speech, which he gave on April 3rd, 1968, known as the speech, "I Have Been to the Mountaintop."
You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing and I said, "Yes." And the next minute I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. And that blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. Yes. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said.
Yes.
But there was another letter.
All right.
What about? It came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." And she said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, I want to say tonight that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in all Bennett, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. And the black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We're sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life, longevity.
Martin Luther King, April 3rd, 1968, the night before he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. The federal King holiday, which started in 83, was first observed in 86, has overlapped with Inauguration Day just two other times. First, with Bill Clinton in 1997, and then again with President Obama in 2013. Obama also took his oath of office using a Bible that belonged to Dr. Martin Luther King. The King family has been extremely critical of President Trump, But the youngest of the civil rights leader's four children, Bernice King, said of Martin Luther King Day coinciding with the Trump inauguration, quote, "It's wonderful this occurs on the King holiday, the inauguration, because it reminds us of King," she said. You can see all of our Martin Luther King programs by going to democracynow.org. Special thanks to the Democracy Now! Team in Washington, D.C. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Woronoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Turrieri, Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. To get a copy of our daily newsletter, you can go to democracynow.org and sign up, or text the word Democracy Now! To 668-66. That does it for our show. Happy Dr. Martin Luther King Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Dr. Oscar Adoli, bringing you the best mix of music.